In today's lecture, I want to explore a historical fact, a basic historical fact about the concept of the hero. And that is that heroes in the ancient Greek world were not only told about in epic drama and the other media we're going to see, they were also worshipped. This is a matter of Greek religion. And for the entire historical span of what we are studying, we can go as far back as the 8th century BCE or further back, and all the way forward to the author that I'm featuring today in item C of the handout, Philostratus Heroicus. I hope you have the handout with you. And his date is 200 AD. So all the way from, let's say, the 800s to 200 AD, people were worshipping heroes. And if I were to summarize in one sentence what my research trajectory has been over the last 25 years, it has been to show that the way people worship heroes is relevant to the way heroes are talked about in epic and in tragedy and in the other media. And if you think, well, so what? This is not obvious. And it's not obvious simply from reading the literature. And that's why today I go out of my way to spell this out. I'd like to give you a very brief crash course on hero cult as a historical phenomenon in ancient Greek civilization. And take good notes, because the notes you take in class, although they'll be supplemented by even richer notes that I've taken myself for you, and which you will see on the splash page on your website, nevertheless, make things more immediate. Sometimes I can say things in a very few words that take me a very long time to say in what I write. So this is a short version. You'll see a longer version just by opening up the website and looking at the splash page. When I say religion, I mean the interaction of ritual and myth. And I've already defined ritual and myth for you. If you'd like to review that for the midterm, that too is revisited in the splash page. Here's some very, very basic things, 15 of them, about hero cult. Number one, hero cults were local, fundamentally local. That is to say, it's local religious practice, it's local interaction with myth and ritual. And even some of the heroes that are best known to us from the Iliad and Odyssey and from the tragedies we have read and will read can be worshipped in local cult. Then there'll be other local cult heroes that you never hear of anywhere else. And they're male cult heroes, they're female cult heroes, they're even underage baby cult heroes. This all has to do with a fundamental aspect of ancient Greek religion. To repeat, it's a historical fact. Number two, ordinarily, the hero cult was based on the fact, the understood fact, that the body of the given hero was, if I may say it quickly, planted in the local Mother Earth. That is to say, without the body as an anchor to the cult, without the body as an anchor to the ritual and myth, there is no hero cult. And the word for body is soma, S-O-M-A. And sometimes the locals may not have had the whole body, they might have had a part of the body, like a head or a thumb, or even by metonymy, an article of clothing, a weapon, something that the hero had touched sometime during their life. Touching is a really good metonymy, anything that has to be connected to the hero. Number three, this body, or part of the body, or parts touched by the body, was considered a talisman of fertility and prosperity to the local worshippers, to the locals. And fertility was viewed primarily in terms of plant life, vegetation, okay? Especially in terms of what you harvest from the plant life. So it could be a field, a garden, a grove, an orchard, a vineyard, etc., etc. So that's your primary way of imagining fertility. It's also, of course, animal fertility, and that has to do not only with what happens to your domesticated animals, but how well you hunt, or how badly you hunt. And those of you who saw the film, The Map of the Human Heart, there's a beautiful example of fertility as game that is produced by the goddess of the sea. And then lastly, a little switch. Ritual substitution. Okay? Can you still hear me? And notice how clearer it is. Clearer, but needs to be louder. Now better. Okay. So we're still on number three, the talisman of fertility and prosperity. It's not that I have to rewind everything, do I? Good. Number four. The marker, if I can call it this, the marker of the body that is planted in the local earth is called the sema, S-E-M-A. And ordinarily a sema is a tomb. Okay. Number five, there are other kinds of marking too for the body. You could have a sign, like a secret signal, a token, or a picture, a painting. And the word for this kind of marking is also sema. And that's where we get the meaning semantics by way of the Greek idea of meaning. This is so fundamental to meaning that to mark where the body is has basically to do with the Greek word for meaning. So that was five. Number six, the marking could be a secret. Why? Because the marking is sacred, and usually sacred things in many communities are considered secret. And if it is secret, that means that the local community will screen the information about the marking to outsiders. And outsiders are not only people who are aliens or foreigners, but there could be people in your community who do not yet know the secret. So what's the word I'm looking for? Tara, initiation. In other words, the sema can be a key to initiation, right? It could be a secret to...
You remember it from Iliad 1, where every time Achilles is...
water, wine, oil, milk, emulsified honey, combinations of those, the blood of a sacrificed animal, the fresh blood of a sacrificed animal. Again, either meat, so to speak, or mixed in with other ingredients. When you pour blood, what's the purpose? It's to make contact with the consciousness of the dead. And in some cases, we have archaeological evidence that they would have tubes leading from the surface of the earth to the mouth of the corpse so that you can pour the blood directly in. The blood goes in, you have about 5 minutes of contact while the batteries are activated, then the blood gets used up, the consciousness is gone. What do you call the opinion of a hero when you pray to a hero like this? You call it, are you ready? Diagnosis. Why diagnosis? Because heroes were thought to be healers, that promote prosperity and fertility. They would be given secret names like the physician. One such secret name is Jason. Are any of you who are called Jason? Maybe this is not the time to fess up to it, but anyway. Number nine, when you sacrifice to a hero, there's a Jason. When you sacrifice to a hero, you ordinarily look down. You have to have your eyes looking down on the earth under your feet. When you sacrifice to God, you're supposed to look up to the sky. This will become very important when we discuss another film later on, having to do with people who tend to have their eyes fixed on the sky versus people who have their eyes fixed on the local earth. In the reading that we're doing today on Philostratus, this 200 CE or AD person, in Philostratus there's actually an exchange at the very beginning of your reading where it turns out that the Phoenician keeps looking up at the sky, he's looking for the stars so he can get his bearings, whereas the so-called vine dresser, the vineyard keeper, is always looking down on the earth, concentrating on the place where the local hero is planted. Okay, number 10, when you sacrifice to a hero, you can use special taboo words for I sacrifice, and one of them actually means I participate in the guilt. I participate in the guilt. I participate in the pollution. Can't explain that now, but that shows you we still have a lot of explaining to do about the religious dimensions of the hero. I give you a fuller version of this in the notes that are on the splash page. Number 11, ordinarily if you sacrifice to, let's say, a male hero, what do you sacrifice? A ram. I say that because remember you saw the picture of Patroclus as a ram in the slide lecture with the throat slit, sacrificially slit. Number 12, ordinarily when you sacrifice to a hero, you sacrifice into a depression in the earth. So you sacrifice below earth level into a depression. Ordinarily when you sacrifice to a god, a sky god, it's an elevation above the earth. And we have words like altar. Okay. And I give you some really good examples from the Olympics in the expanded notes that you can check if you're interested on the website. Number 13, the sacred space where the hero is worshipped can be coextensive, that is to say, shared with the sacred space of the god who is the divine antagonist of the hero, and that seems sort of counterintuitive to us. Why should you worship the hero and the antagonist god of the hero in exactly the same sacred space, in exactly the same local earth? But this is one of the things we have to grapple with as we read tragedy. We're going to keep coming back to this very interesting historical fact. Number 14, when you're sacrificing to a hero and you know that his body or her body is in your local earth, okay, you think of them as dead, right? But there's no contradiction in ancient Greek religion about simultaneously thinking of that dead hero as alive and immortalized in a beautiful place beyond our time and space. Okay? And that beautiful place will have all sorts of different local names because depending on the local cult, you have different ways of imagining this. And ancient Greeks were very self-conscious and even embarrassed about talking about how they imagined their local heroes in this, may I say it, paradise-like existence beyond our time and place. But one thing that all of these places have in common, and I've studied dozens of them, is that they are always imagined in a beautiful vegetal setting. It can be a beautiful garden, it can be a beautiful vineyard, etc., etc. It could be a beautiful field. All right? And then number 15, the hero can be thought of as potentially resurrected, that is to say, coming back to life at the fullness of time, sometime beyond our time and our place. And this is why you can simultaneously think of the hero as dead in your local earth, but also immortalized somewhere else. Or, and this is the most interesting part, by way of a miracle, the hero can just appear as a phantom, as a phantasm, or depending on local belief, the real thing, in your own life at a specially sacred moment. And they like to appear, they like to, ready for the word, make their epiphanies in sacred moments, when you're praying, when you're sacrificing, when you're taking in the beauties of nature, all those things would work, okay? And you see why I've been harping on the term metonymy as well as metaphor all the time, because you see, even in these religious concepts, this constant obsession with what things the hero has touched personally, which then becomes sacred just because they touched it. And so if they hang out in a sacred place, the whole place is sacred, all right? And similarly, if we're going to get into this, any kind of bodily association of the hero, like let's say the way a hero breathes, will be connected literally with the spot in the garden, the natural phenomena. So the hero's breath will be intimately connected to the breeze that's blowing in a beautiful garden. And so by metonymy you can say, oh my, that hero has sweet breath, and all sorts of other almost uncomfortably religious, sentimental even, feelings that worshippers express to these beings that are not gods, but they're not humans either. Well, this was a 15-minute crash course. You'll see 15 minutes worth of notes that supplement what I just said if you look at the website. Now, what I'm really doing is defamiliarizing our concept of the hero up to now, because we keep thinking of them as characters in epic, characters in tragedy. But look at the passage A in the handout. Here, the disguised Odysseus is comparing his wife Penelope to a just king, a king who is the upholder of justice. Okay? And if you study footnote 1 in your handout, you will see that the Greek idea of justice, of social justice, is regularly metaphorized compared with a beautifully tended garden or field or grove or whatever it is. And that in turn is regularly metaphorized as a straight line, as something where you just know your directions. The opposite is the word hubris, which I also give you in footnote 1, which is an untended garden, something that has been allowed to grow wild, quote-unquote, all right? And that will be metaphorized also as a crooked line. So, straight line, good planting. Crooked line, bad planting. A straight line, justice, social justice. All presided over by the concept of the hero. And so imagine what a beautiful inos this is, and the visualization, what a beautiful sema this is, that Odysseus is projecting his own identity to his wife. He says, you're like a just king, and when a just king is in power. He rules, line 3 and following, over a great and valiant nation. The earth yields its wheat and barley, the trees loaded with fruit, the ewes bring forth lambs, and the sea abounds with fish by reason of his virtues. Beautiful metonymy between Odysseus and Penelope. Similarly with B, remember we've been talking about how difficult it is for Odysseus to be read, to be recognized by his near and dear ones, and how he has to start with the most simple relationships like his dog, and then work his way up from the dog to more and more and more complex relationships with those who are near and dear to him. And the hardest relationship to reconstruct is the relationship he had with his wife, interrupted for 20 years. So there's a lot of reconstructing to do. Or as Desi Arnaz used to say to Lucy, "Lucy, you've got a lot of splaining to do." Only this time it's Odysseus who has to do the explaining. And after Penelope, there's somebody who is even more difficult to reconstruct your relations with, and that's, it looks as if the top of Odysseus' ascending scale of affection as far as his near and dear ones are concerned, just in terms of how the plot develops, and that's his father. And we've seen how important fathers are, even in the name Patroclus, which means he who has the glory of the fathers. So it's maybe not a surprise to us that the hardest relationship for Odysseus to reconstruct is that with his father. So isn't it wonderful that when he meets him and when they have their click, their coming together of minds and hearts, it happens in a garden. And there's a beautiful description here of how Laertes, the father of Odysseus, is sad and grieving, right? And he stood under a tall pear tree, you see line 5, and began to weep. This is now Odysseus. And then he's wondering whether he should instantly identify himself or whether he has to play his usual game so that he can try to reconstruct genuinely the relationship. I'm emphasizing again that this is happening in a beautiful garden, a great orchard. I see, sir, he says, starting at line 244, if you're an excellent gardener, what pains you take with it. There's not a single plant, not a fig tree, vine, olive, pear, nor flower bed, but bears the trace of your attention. Again, I'm trying to defamiliarize the scene so you realize that this is not just a story about heroes. There's a hidden agenda about cult heroes, and there are lots of signals for us, the uninitiated, so that we can get initiated into this mentality of being a part of hero cult.